I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, we have in our packet the minutes from January 12, 2017, with Representative Kunesh Prodeen. Move the minutes.
Yes.
Yes, I do. Representative Kunesh Prodeen, am I saying that right?
Kunesh Prodeen.
Kunesh Prodeen.
Thank you.
Has moved the minutes for January 12, 2017. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Members, today we have before us the Minnesota Management and Budget Department overview. We have Commissioner Franz here, and he is going to walk us through. We also have some additional documents in your folder that Ms. Roberts helped put together, and I will go over those as well, probably towards the tail end, I think. But I want to give Commissioner Franz an opportunity to walk us through his committee. It looks like he has a team of folks here to help him out. So feel free to phone a friend anytime you need to, Commissioner. And with that, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide an overview today. As Chair Anderson mentioned, I am going to ask some of my senior team members to come up and explain some of the areas. I think it will help with any questions you have and dialogue that we have about the different areas. Minnesota Management and Budget has a really wide portfolio of activities, so I think it'll be helpful. Plus, they're better at it than I am. But I just wanted to really say thank you for this opportunity. One of the things that we are also working on, we received the chair's letter asking for some more detailed information, and we're working on that, and we'll have some of that information today, but we're really focusing on the overview today, and we'll be working on that the other questions you had to provide a better overview of M&B. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to do is do a quick overview, then I'll bring up some of my assistant commissioners and deputy commissioners and director to kind of talk about different systems. The first one I'll bring up in just a minute will be the Assistant Commissioner for Accounting, Cindy Farrell. But let me do a quick overview. I've talked with almost all of you and seen some of you before, and I know some of you are new to the State Government Committee, so welcome, and we look forward to working together this year with all of you. The M&B was created in 2008 following the Department of Finance and the Employee Relations merger. So that's how we got from Department of Finance to M&B, where we also picked up the Central Human Resources Office. We'd like to talk about serving the people of Minnesota at M&B, and our mission is to serve the people of Minnesota by providing the state with leadership and guidance to support efficient, effective government, a world-class workforce, and responsible financial management. And that's why I look forward to working with this committee and you, Madam Chair, to make sure we deliver on that mission. And as Commissioner, I'm directed by statute to act as the state's chief accounting officer, the principal financial officer, and the state controller. We're also responsible for human resource management, as I mentioned, payroll, employee insurance, collective bargaining on behalf of the state, and the collecting and the employee bargaining units. We have about 240 employees at M&B. We'll get more detail on this when we talk to you in a couple of weeks in terms of our employee count over the years, but our responsibility is to work really becoming increasingly extensive and complex, as our senior staff will explain today. The number of employees at M&B is really near its lowest point in about the last 10 years, but the statutory required work that we do and the number of people that we serve in the state has grown significantly over that time frame. We at the time that we started tracking some of this information, the overall population of Minnesota was not nearly what it is today. We continue to feel that pressure through the other agencies, but I'll explain that in more detail, how it is that M&B interfaces with the other agencies. So we do serve the people of Minnesota. We serve 55,000 state employees, which includes the Minnesota State Colleges and University system through the payroll system. We serve over 100 state agencies, boards and commissions. We work with the governor, obviously, the judicial branch, and the legislature. So let me just go briefly over the top areas of responsibility that we have. In the finance area, we prepare, coordinate, and execute the biennial budget. We currently have a $76 billion all-funds budget for this biennium. We also are involved in the annual preparation, coordination, and execution of the capital budget. And as many of you know, in the last 30 years, all but 2 years, we've implemented, the legislature has approved, and the governor has signed a capital budget. We're also involved in the sale and issuance of state general obligation bonds, revenue bonds, appropriation bonds, and other public financing. For example, in August, just this last August, we sold about $800 million of bonds to support the state infrastructure projects passed by the legislature. We also currently oversee $8 billion in state public debt at this time. We're responsible for maintaining the books of account, the administration of the statewide accounting system, and the central disbursement system. The financial records of the state, as well as banking and cash management activities. The budgetary fund statements for most all state funds runs through MMB. You and all of your staff are aware that we work primarily in the general fund. A lot of our discussions take place talking about the general fund activities. But we report on 37 operating funds in our consolidated fund statement. Many of these funds have multiple sub-funds within them. In total, we have 187 funds in the state accounting system itself. We also operate and control the allotment system or the appropriation system, which directs each state agency to break down their appropriation into different activity levels so that you can, at the legislature, can see what activities they're engaged in. We prepare and deliver to the governor and the legislature twice a year budget and economic forecast, the next forecast coming up in late February, early March. We have quarterly economic updates that we provide and monthly revenue memos that give the report of the amount of revenues brought in each month. We're statutorily required to maintain internal control programs. And control programs are the plans, methods, policies, and procedures that are put into place to make sure that we actually do what we are supposed to do, what we set out to do. Management implements internal controls to reduce the opportunities for someone to commit fraud without being detected. An example of an internal control that we adhere to is a separation of duties. We never want one person to be responsible for a transaction from the start to the finish. We also have human resource responsibilities. We have administration of the state payroll system. We issue approximately 55,000 paychecks every 2 weeks, of which 97% are direct deposit. We maintain the state's online payroll, human resources, and benefits system, which has over 2,000 users spread throughout the agencies. We develop and maintain employee, retiree, and dependent insurance benefits for approximately 127,000 people, commonly known as CGIP, State Employee Group Insurance Plan. We negotiate and administer 9 collective bargaining agreements, and we supervise 2 compensation plans within state government. We oversee and coordinate human resource policy for agencies, for boards, and for commissions. We coordinate planning and preparation among agencies to make sure that the agencies continue providing priority services under a broad range of circumstances, from weather emergencies to disasters to a lapse in funding. MMB maintains 8 statewide IT systems. The statewide accounting system, which is called the Statewide Integrated Financial Tools, or SWIFT. We have the budget system that many of you work with, called the Budget Planning Analysis System, or BPAS. We have the capital budget system. We have the fiscal note tracking system. We have the human resource system, commonly referred to as Semaphore, as some of you know of. We have the job application system that we recently upgraded and called the recruiting solutions. We have the enterprise learning management system, or ELM. We also have a data warehouse. So you can see that MMB is heavily involved with Minute and monitoring these IT systems that we'll be talking to you about extensively throughout today and throughout this session. Since the beginning of this administration, we have tried to accomplish government more effectively, more efficiently, and we want to build on these successes. We want to partner with this agency and other this committee and other committees to make sure that we provide this information to the constituents that we all have. You know, we recently, in 2011, began with a series of deficits in the prior decade. We inherited a $6 billion deficit, and we owed over $2 billion to our schools. So we've repaid that debt. We've recorded 7 straight positive budget balances, and we also now have a $678 million announced of surplus or balance for November for the next biennium. We've instituted a new reserve policy that is a model for other states and has ensured that we are well-positioned for the next economic downturn. The state's budget reserve is at an all-time high. We have an historic amount with over $1.9 billion. This approach has been lauded around the country as one of the best approaches to deciding how much to put in the reserve and how to go about doing it. We've improved our management of our state's financial strength, and that's been recognized by Wall Street experts. We recently were upgraded to AAA this last summer when we sold the bonds in August. We have financed various bond issuances and refinanced a number of others. So we've saved the state over $132 million in state service debt costs by refinancing. We've worked with agencies to ensure that their budget pages, which are online that I mentioned in the letter to you, Chair Anderson, that we have plain language in all of those documents. We've implemented the new Pew Research Results First initiative. Some of you may recall several years ago the legislature and the governor agreed to adopt this data-driven method of assessing state government programs with the idea to provide you, policymakers, with information on what programs work and where best to invest resources for desired outcomes. We'll be talking about more about that this session as well. We've really placed a big emphasis on diversifying the state's workforce to more accurately reflect the workforce of our state. We've increased hiring people with disabilities, and we've diversified our racial and ethnic backgrounds. We've hired people with disabilities and has increased from 5.8% to 6.3%, and our hiring of racial and ethnic background diversity has increased from 9.7% to 14.9%. We've consolidated human resources, labor relations, and employee insurance to provide a single focus on these areas to work together in unison to be more efficient and effective. As an example, rather than having labor relations negotiate a contract with employees and then have the human resource team sort out the implementation, our whole team acts as one to make sure that we manage the workforce needs while we are negotiating our contracts. We've improved our transparency Minnesota website. The positive impact of all these state agents, of all this in state agencies, I think, has been enormous. We're proud of the work that we've accomplished at M&B. We take our responsibility very seriously, and we want to do everything we can to do a better job for all Minnesotans. So I've asked some of our leaders to come forward and describe their divisions in more detail to give you added information. But what I want to emphasize today is that M&B's leadership role in helping the state succeed. We've repeatedly demonstrated that M&B can provide resources to agencies to help them work more consistently, efficiently, and to avoid a reduced compliance or legal issues. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like Assistant Commissioner for Accounting Cindy Farrell to come up and talk about the accounting division.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Farrell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Accounting Services Division. The Accounting Services Division is the foundation that supports the state's financial operations. We provide the statutorily required infrastructure for efficient and effective accounting and payroll services that are conducted throughout the state. Our primary customers are state agencies, as well as the individuals and organizations that do business with the state. The division operates through three sections, statewide payroll services, statewide accounting, and SWIFT system support. All three sections establish and maintain statewide financial policies and procedures designed to safeguard assets and ensure compliance with legal requirements. They also provide advice, consultation, and technical assistance to agencies regarding financial management practices. The statewide payroll services section consists of 16 staff and processes the biweekly payroll for state employees. We pay approximately 55,000 employees every 2 weeks, and we issued over 1.4 million paychecks in fiscal year 2016. This section ensures that all payroll deductions are processed and remitted correctly, including state and federal taxes, retirement, insurance, savings plans, charitable contributions, union dues, parking, child support deductions, as well as garnishments. The team reconciles and files quarterly and annual payroll tax reports to the IRS, the State of Minnesota, Department of Revenue, and up to 40 other states. The team just issued over 70,000 W-2s for calendar year 2016. This team also maintains a centralized payroll system, which has over 2,000 users in state agencies across the state. It also maintains the system which enables state employees to enter their timesheets and business expenses, maintain their direct deposit information, access their pay stubs, leave balances, and annual W-2 forms. The team also maintains content on our website, the online help information that's contained within our payroll system, and issues periodic payroll bulletins, which contain information and instructions for state agencies about various payroll-related topics. The statewide accounting section consists of 20 employees who work in three teams. Cash management team reconciles the activity in over 600 bank accounts where agencies deposit their funds to. On a daily basis, we sweep all those deposits into a central account where we issue all the state's payments from. The team monitors cash flow and determines the amount available for the State Board of Investment to invest each day. We also ensure that the banks maintain the appropriate amount of collateral to protect our deposits. The general accounting team ensures that the state's financial transactions are recorded correctly in the system. It approves various journal entries that are made or entered by state agencies. This team performs various reconciliations on a daily, monthly, quarterly, and annual basis. The team allocates investment earnings to the appropriate funds. It also prepares the annual statewide cost allocation plan for the federal government and a legal level of budgetary control report. The financial reporting team prepares the state's annual financial statements in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. The report is called the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or CAFR, and we just issued a CAFR for fiscal year 16 in December, and this is all available online on our website. I'm proud to say that our CAFR has achieved the Certificate of Excellence in Financial Reporting from the Government Finance Officers Association for 31 years in a row. The team also prepares and submits required reports to the federal government, including the annual single audit report, the annual Cash Management Improvement Act report, and quarterly and annual revenue and expenditure reports to the U.S. Census Bureau. The last section is the SWIFT System Support section, and that has 29 employees. This team maintains the state's financial system called SWIFT, which stands for Statewide Integrated Financial Tool. It is used by approximately 6,000 state employees and is the official system of record for the state's finances. The team maintains statewide configurations in the system, such as security and transaction workflow, troubleshoots problems with transactions and batch processes, and works on making enhancements and fixing bugs within the system. This group also provides training and user reference material for the 17 different modules within SWIFT. They also provide support to agency users through the SWIFT Help Desk. This team also maintains content on our website and issues the weekly SWIFT newsletter to agency staff. This section also establishes the approved agency budgets and coordinates the annual fiscal closing process, where we close our books. It also maintains the open checkbook portion of our Transparency Minnesota website. That site makes agency budget and expenditure information available to the general public. The website was awarded the State Government Innovation Award in 2015 from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Also within this section, the vendor payments team is responsible for issuing the state's payments. This team establishes and maintains our master file of over 300,000 state vendors, which include individuals, businesses, nonprofit organizations, school districts, and other governmental units. The team provides a help desk for vendors and responds to approximately 2,000 calls per month. This team also issues payments through warrant and electronic funds transfer. Over 2.5 million payments were issued in fiscal year 2016, averaging approximately $50,000 per week. It also processes backup withholding, offsets for the federal government and the State Department of Revenue, and various garnishments and levies. This team also prepares the annual 1099 and quarterly excise tax reports to the IRS, reports unclaimed property to the Department of Commerce, submits monthly sales tax reports to the Department of Revenue, and prepares the annual prompt payment report, which shows the timeliness of state agency payments. I'm very proud of our team, and Minnesotans should be proud of our strong financial management practices. This concludes my prepared remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. We do have a question here. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Farrell?
Yes.
Over here. Hi. Question for you. On your handout, your pie chart as to where things are spent, your non-healthcare-based budget by activity, in your IT piece of the pie, You've got lease, admin, minute at $9 million, and then your statewide IT at $26 million. My question is that what we in IT would call like iron on the floor, or is that software? Can you kind of detail me, or detail for me what is in that $26 million?
I think that's probably a better question for Commissioner France.
Right.
Well, actually.
Or does she? Okay, excellent.
Madam Chair and Representative, the majority of those costs that are depicted in that part of the pie are paid to Minute to support our IT systems, all of our enterprise systems that Commissioner Franz mentioned. Consists of staffing within Minute. There's software licensing cost, hardware, lots of IT general related expense. The funds depicted here, I believe, also include appropriations that were made by the legislature last year to help us to upgrade our statewide systems. We have completed or nearly completed on upgrading our People Tools application, which is kind of the guts supporting our PeopleSoft system. And we are also well underway in an upgrade of our Enterprise Learning Management System, ELM, to the latest version. And we are planning currently for the upgrade of our SWIFT financial system.
Oh, Representative Nash.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. And once again, just to clarify, so you've got $9 million listed as minutes, but then underneath it, you've got statewide IT at $26 million. And are you saying that that 26 is also to Minute, or what's going to Minute and what's being spent internally specifically by you? I'm just trying to figure out what all is going to Minute and what you're doing internally.
Madam Chair and Representative, of that $26 million, about $1.7 million per year is spent within my division for the support staff that I referenced earlier in the SWIFT system support section.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Fans, maybe I don't want to bog this down. Will you get me the details of that? Because you have Minute listed as $9 million and then more 26 listed, but also composing of Minute. And I just want to know what's getting spent where, for what, and what all that is. So if you could help me out maybe after committee tomorrow, or if you know the answer now.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, what I'd like to do is put together a more detailed analysis for you so you can see, because Minute is involved in so much of what we do, but that, it'd be easier, I think, to provide that to you, then you can decide how you want to share it with the committee, if that's okay.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason for that is, you know, Minute was created ostensibly to consolidate, and I want to try to help you resist the temptation to bring things back into your own agency, because I think that that's probably counterintuitive to what we've tried to do, and it doesn't make sense from an IT guy's perspective either. So if you would get that for us, that'd be great.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Farrell, I'm really interested in your prompt payment report and all of that. Obviously, paying vendors on time is very important. What's your performance level on that? If a vendor is net 30, are you able to meet those terms? And then secondly, are you able to take advantage and be nimble enough to take advantage of cash discounts and things like that?
Ms. Brough.
Madam Chair and Representative, overall, the statewide average percentage of prompt payment is about 98%. We do have a detailed report available also on our website, which breaks it down by agencies. We are able to take advantage of discounts if provided by vendors. And if a state agency does not pay their vendor within the 30 days as required by law, the vendor is entitled to interest.
Representative Hugo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little follow-up then. When you do have disputed vendor amounts or whatever, what's your process for that and how fast do you turn that around?
Ms. Farrell.
Madam Chair and Representative, disputes will be taken up individually with the agency, and so each agency may have their own process. We don't have a dispute unit in my area.
Hmm. Representative Eagle?
Okay, no, that's what I was driving at, so you don't. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Farrell, I just have a couple of questions. So how many on the payroll side of things, how many new employees are you getting within a month that you have to get into the system and so forth on the payroll side of things? Can you give me a ballpark figure? I'm sure it probably varies by season, but...
Madam Chair, I do not know how many employees are activated in a month. That may be a question for Deputy Commissioner over Enterprise Human Resources. The HR side would be the team that is activating new employees. We cut the checks after they're active.
But on how many new checks do you have to cut? Can you give me an idea based on how many new checks that you have to get into the system and cut on a monthly basis?
Madam Chair, there's constant churn within the state where new employees are coming on, other employees are leaving. We don't track that type of information. If you wanted a comparison of number of checks issued per pay period, I could provide that to you.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. And if the commissioner, the HR person, too, can give me an idea of how many new people per month on the payroll, I think that would be helpful as well.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Deputy Hudson will give you some more information about that when he comes up, too.
Great. Any other questions? Representative Quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and whoever's best to answer it. There was some discussion about price breaks and that, so do all of our vendors, are they aggregated across government agencies so we get the, if you add them all together, you get a higher quantity. I know we have a thing for schools of where we use the state vendor stuff. I would assume since the largest employers tend to be, government employers, and I think Mayo is still the first private, there's a large quantity that if we did aggregate across all government entities, then we might be able to, get better price points, or is it just by MMB, the ones you interact with? If I can better understand that, maybe I can see what the different purchasing groups and entities across the state might enjoy.
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair and Representative, state procurement is administered by the Department of Administration. They oversee all purchasing, and vendors are consolidated. They do negotiate contracts with vendors on behalf of the entire state, so they are looking at the entire state's volumes. They also... the contracts that they negotiate are also available to other public sector units within the state, local governments, and school districts. So they do tend to capitalize on volume wherever possible.
Okay, Representative Kwan.
Thank you. And then stepping over into the IT realm, there was a mention of data warehouse. Is that more of a statewide cloud, or are there multiple cloudlets that the state hosts in order to leverage, you've got the sufficient size capability, that way it saves money not having that storage out all across the state?
Ms. Farrell?
Madam Chair and Representative, our data warehouse is in-house. To my knowledge, it's not located in the cloud at this point. The data warehouse has information from our accounting and payroll system, and it's administered by Minute. I couldn't speak to the technical architecture of that.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. If maybe you could allow me to get in touch with the appropriate so I can understand, because you can have an internal cloud within an organization and where that might be, so that as you've got these 5 to 8 different platforms and the compatibility, if you can merge, whatever you can merge statewide, could be some savings and also help with, it doesn't make sense when you update each individual if you don't have a final endpoint where you have unity and merger, which would, make it easier and less expensive.
Yeah, and Representative Quam, we will have Minute coming before the committee at some point as well, and so we can make sure that you get connected on that too. Okay, members, any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like Budget Director Kelly, Assistant Commissioner and Budget Director Margaret Kelly, to come talk about the budget division.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner over the Budget Services Division. I'm happy to be here today to talk to you about the work we do. We work in the Budget Division collaboratively across MMB, across state government, and with the legislature to accomplish our work. Statute governs most of what we do. It directs us to prepare the budget. It specifies the form and content of the budget. It directs us to complete a budget and economic forecast. It requires reporting on and monitoring of agency budgets, requires performance measures and results activities, and it requires MMB overall to manage the state finances. There are 30 people working in the budget division and on one of three teams. We have a budget policy and analysis team that consists of the executive budget officers, or EBOs, who manage a portfolio of agencies and their budgets. We have a budget operations support team, which manages our statewide reporting and are the business side of our IT systems. And we have a results management team that coordinates statewide results management efforts and results first implementation. The work of the budget division is to create and share objective, relevant, and information and tools for decision makers, and to coordinate and communicate fiscal policy statewide. We have a variety of products and processes that help us achieve these goals. We coordinate the governor's capital and operating budget decision-making processes for state agencies for regular and special legislative sessions. We publish the governor's capital and operating budget recommendations. With his capital budgets, we collect and publish agency and local government requests, and then we publish the governor's recommendations. With operating budgets, we publish agency-based budgets, and then again, the governor's recommendations. We work collaboratively with the governor's office and the legislature to determine every biennium the form and format of the budget documents that you use. We coordinate the fiscal note process. We work to ensure agencies respond in a timely fashion. We review their analysis for accuracy and reasonableness, and we publish completed notes. We maintain and we publish fund statements, the state's bottom line, for the general fund and 36 other funds. We work closely with the accounting services and debt management divisions at MMB to monitor agency spending and to ensure it is consistent with legislative decisions. We work with MINUT to maintain the systems that are the basis of our work, our budget systems for operating and capital budgets, and our fiscal note system. We work closely with the economic analysis team at MMB, a team of three economists, to produce the November and February budget and economic forecasts. These are the basis of the budget setting processes that you will undertake this session. And we publish numerous reports, the price of government, the economic and budget forecasts, agency departmental earnings, the disaster assistance fund report, permanent school funding report, results first metrics, just to name a few. We work with state agencies to improve their use of data and performance metrics. We're working specifically now with Corrections and Human Services and local governments on cost-benefit analysis for certain services. And we review and approve agency spending plans and internal service fund rates. And that's the work of our division. It keeps us busy 24/7. Sometimes it feels like. But unless you have questions, I'm going to turn it back to Commissioner France.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, tell me a little bit about more about the budget economic forecast and how that's put together. And secondly, I'm just curious about fiscal notes and briefly, what is your assessment on how well that's working out?
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll take the latter first. With fiscal notes, I think we do about as best we can, and I'd be happy to hear from all of you as to how you think it's working out. A couple of years ago, the OLA did an audit of the fiscal note process and came up with a series of recommendations for both MMB, state agencies, and the legislature. We have implemented all but one of the recommendations for MMB and state agencies. So to the extent that there are improvements to be made that have already been recommended, we've done those, incorporated them into our processes. As far as the forecast goes, it is a month to a month and a half long process. From the budget side, we work with state agencies that have forecasted expenditure programs like Department of Education and the Gen Ed formula, Department of Human Services and our Medicaid spending, to review trends and to understand their projections for spending obligations going forward. State economists look at national and state economic indicators, use a forecast by an international forecasting agency, IHS, to make determinations about Minnesota's economy and how that is going to impact revenues in the state. And we bring those two together to determine how revenues and spending are going to change and how our bottom line changes.
Commissioner, you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, Representative, great job, Budget Director Kelly. I just might mention that the Council of Economic Advisors will be meeting twice in February. They always meet twice before the forecast comes out to review national trends and then specifically, you know, Minnesota trends. So that will be happening in February as we get ready for the next forecast. And it's a great process where the economist, or the state economist, Laura Columbakidis, gets an opportunity to talk to economists around the state about what they see nationally. We also hire IHS as a consultant to provide us with the global views and national views, but we get the input from these local economists as well to provide sort of that extra touch. So there's a lot that will be happening in February as we get ready for the February forecast.
Thank you.
And Ms. Kelly, I have a question. Some members have questions about the speed of the fiscal notes. I'm just curious about the accuracy of the fiscal notes themselves and what kind of process your department goes through to look at past fiscal notes and determine if they actually hit the mark or not.
Madam Chair, we have...
Are the agencies living up to the mark that's set, and how do you determine that?
Madam Chair, we have an agreement with fiscal staff that a kind of a standard default time frame in which fiscal notes get done, from the point at which they're requested to when they'll be signed off by MMB, typically is between 5 to 7 days. There are requests where the legislature can ask for them to be done more urgently, but some fiscal notes are simply complicated and require a lot of research and analysis on the part of agencies and may take longer to do. And some agencies that have a substantial number of fiscal notes to do, it's the same person doing all of the fiscal notes, and we work with the legislature to prioritize which ones need to be done first. They cannot all be done within that same 5 to 7 day window. So we work as hard as we can to ensure that agencies are able to turn around their fiscal notes as quickly as possible. And for the most part, the majority of our fiscal notes are completed in the time requested. Some take longer. Some don't get done because the legislature decided not to pursue that fiscal note. As far as following up on what actually happened, most fiscal notes are simply appropriations in law for agencies to spend, and we rely on agencies to work with their committees to determine if those dollars were spent accordingly. Other fiscal notes are changes in forecasted programs, and we try to reflect that as we pick those things up in the forecast, subsequent November and February forecasts.
And Ms. Kelly, does your department go to other states to review how they do their fiscal notes to get a better idea of maybe we need to change our policies? Because I guess my biggest concern is, does the fiscal note actually tell us what the program change would cost, or does it set the level at which we're going to spend money?
Madam Chair, we ask agencies, and if you think we're asking agencies to do the wrong thing, we are open to suggestions and to how to improve the fiscal note process. It's a process to help you determine the impact that your legislation will have. So we ask agencies to describe their assumptions for implementing the language in the law or the language in the bill. So based on the language, what are the cost implications for the agency? And we ask agencies to describe their assumptions so that you can review those assumptions and see if, in your mind, they're reasonable, to see if they are interpreting the language the way in which you intended them to do, so that you can make modifications to agencies' assumptions, which then would impact the fiscal note itself. So the intent there is to describe the fiscal costs of the language that's included in the bill.
Members, any other questions? Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. Often we do talk about the cost impact for agencies of a fiscal note. Can you ever do cost savings to agency?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, oftentimes agencies will show an impact, will reduce agency spending.
Representative Fenton. Members, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like Assistant Commissioner Jen Hassemer for Debt Management to come forward.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Hassemer, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management at MMB. The Debt Management Division is responsible for both the sale and management of state debt obligations and the implementation of enacted capital budgets and the compliance associated with each. We do all of this with a small team of four people. The Constitution authorizes the state to issue general obligation bonds, which are secured by the state's full faith and credit pledge regarding their payment. State statute further grants MMB the responsibility for issuing general obligation bonds and managing this debt. We sell general obligation bonds for both capital projects financed in a bonding bill and trunk highway projects, and we have also sold state appropriation bonds, revenue bonds, and certificates of participation for projects as authorized by special legislation. Currently, the state has over $8 billion in net tax-supported debt outstanding. This includes $6.45 billion in general obligation bonds, which is further broken down as $4.45 billion for various purpose bonds, which finance the kinds of projects in a bonding bill, and $2 billion in trunk highway bonds. We have $1.4 billion in outstanding state appropriation bonds, $103 million in outstanding certificates of participation, and $98 million outstanding for other real estate capital leases. The Debt Management Division sets and maintains capital investment guidelines. These guidelines communicate state policy regarding debt and long-term financial planning for capital projects. The guidelines help inform policymakers and guide the decision-making process. The current guidelines were implemented in 2009 and brought the state in line with how the rating agencies were looking at the state's debt obligations. The state has three current guidelines, two of which measure the state's net tax-supported debt against state personal income, and the third measures how quickly the state pays down its debt. The state is currently in compliance with all three of its guidelines, and the Debt Management Division produces a debt capacity forecast as required by statute twice a year in conjunction with the budget and economic forecast. In this document, we report on our current debt metrics as well as how the state is managing to its capital investment guidelines. As I mentioned previously, the Debt Management Division sells bonds on behalf of the state. We conduct at least one general obligation bond sale a year, and depending on market conditions, we may split that into two sales separated by a couple months. Typically, these sales occur in late summer, and last August of 2016, we sold about $800 million in general obligation bonds. Of those bonds, about $550 million financed new or ongoing capital projects, and we also refinanced some previously issued debt, saving the state $40 million over 13 years. In October of last year, we refinanced certain 911 revenue bonds that were originally issued to finance the build-out of the state's emergency communication network, saving the state almost $8 million over 10 years. We also sold state appropriation bonds to finance the next phase of the Lewis and Clark Rural Water System Project in southwest Minnesota. In the lead up to a bond sale, the Debt Management Division will work with our financial advisors and bond counsel on the timing and structure of our bond issuances. We will work with state agencies on their cash flow estimates so that we can appropriately size our bonds. And we will communicate with underwriters and investors who stand to invest in the state's bonds. Debt management seeks to obtain the most favorable interest rates to the state, thereby achieving the lowest cost to the state's debt portfolio. When refinancing existing obligations, we seek a minimum 5% savings overall. In the run-up to a bond sale, we will also prepare offering materials that in our industry we refer to as an official statement. It's a very dense and detailed look at the state's financial condition, and this document is used by investors as they make their decisions as whether or not to invest in the state's bonds. That official statement is also used as we seek to obtain credit rating reviews from the major credit rating agencies. And in the last couple years, the state's credit ratings have seen positive changes. Fitch upgraded the state to a AAA rating just last August in 2016, and the year before, Standard & Poor's upgraded the state's outlook to a positive outlook. The Debt Management Division is also responsible for ensuring compliance with federal tax and securities laws that apply to municipal bonds. The vast majority of the debt that debt management sells is issued on a tax-exempt basis, which means that investors that hold their bonds can exclude any interest income earned from their federal income taxes. But in return, the state must comply with a host of federal tax regulations. Further, the IRS requires the state to maintain a robust post-issuance compliance policy that serves as our internal controls document. This document covers issues such as how the bond proceeds are used and how they are invested, when the proceeds are used, and how the finance projects are used. The SEC does not directly regulate the issuance of tax-exempt debt, unlike in the corporate world, but the state is held to strict anti-fraud standards. The last major area of responsibility of the Debt Management Division is in the implementation of capital budgets enacted by the legislature. The legislature appropriates bond proceeds to state agencies, and debt management works to educate and train those users of the state's debt on the appropriate use thereof. This includes restrictions found in the Constitution, various state statutes, and federal tax law. And we further fulfill various statutory mandates regarding the use and management of capital projects. During the development of a capital budget and in consultation with bond counsel, debt management works with the budget division and other stakeholders to vet the bondability of proposed projects. And that concludes my prepared remarks for today, but I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple takeaways I have is that we're in a very good debt position. We have excellent bond ratings. My question is, who do we attribute this to? Is this the governor, the legislature, the general economy, your work, combination of all those things? Or any idea?
Senator Johnson? Ms. Hassmer.
Madam Chair, I'd like to start off for a
Commissioner. Remark.
I think everybody, I mean, really, when you think about what's happening in Minnesota, obviously, since the Great Recession, Minnesota's been on a trajectory of recovery, so has most of the country, but Minnesota's been on a particularly good, you know, trajectory for recovery. We started off getting jobs right away faster than most states, but we've maintained a good job climate. We actually are seeing our workforce tightening because our unemployment is so low, but we've seen really balanced budgets. We've seen investments in education. I really don't think you can take any one thing. I really do believe that Minnesota is a success story because businesses and people in Minnesota invest here. They grow their businesses here. We all benefit from that. So, you know, the policymakers here at the legislature, the governor, I frankly think that you all deserve a pat on the back. We all do. I'll credit Assistant Commissioner Hassmer with all success at MMB, but it is a group thing. I mean, Minnesota is doing well for a lot of reasons, and I think we should be proud of that. I think the rating agencies, they are a third-party view about all this, and they don't just hand out AAAs for no reason at all. And so we were very pleased to see we didn't expect an upgrade, frankly, in August from Fitch's. We thought it might be another year or so. So we were very pleased to see that because that ultimately saves us money when we borrow. When we sell our bonds, we'll save money with this lower credit rating. So it's a great success story, frankly. I didn't mean to take that home run away, that little softball away from you. But.
And I don't think I could top that.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, I heard you say it, but I don't see it spelled out specifically in here. But we've got approximately $8.2 billion in bonding debt right now. Is that correct?
Ms. Hassmer?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have just over $8 billion outstanding. I believe it's in the realm of $8.04 or so.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then what is the debt service that we pay biannually right now?
Ms. Hassmer?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not have that exact number with me. As I recall, on a biennial basis, we are in the realm of $1.2 billion for a biennium for the general obligation debt. I can get a more exact figure, too, if you would like.
Yeah, I would like that. Thank you.
Representative Buechlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions about refinancing bonds and everything else. You mentioned that you saved quite a bit of money with refi and everything else. What are your benchmarks as far as deciding when you're going to refi? Obviously, it's interest related, but specifically, what type of interest spreads?
Ms. Hassmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. That information, I will have to disclose for the committee. I've been on this job for about 5 months now and have not gone through an actual general obligation bond sale yet. I know overall we seek net present value savings of 5%, and I believe on a maturity-by-maturity basis we seek a 3% savings. Other than that, we do work with our financial advisors to watch the market in terms of where the interest rates are currently and where other states may be coming in or other large issuers may be coming into the market to take advantage of favorable interest or market conditions.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in many cases, you're relying on your financial advisor to advise you that it would be advantageous to refi?
Ms. Hassmer.
Madam Chair, Representative, we look at the markets ourselves. We talk to our financial advisors, and we often have solicitations from underwriters within the investment community as well.
Okay. Representative Uglin.
Then, last question is, so we generate these savings through refi, which is a great deal, and many governments do that. So these savings, do they go back to the general fund, or where do they go?
Ms. Hassmer?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the savings will be reflected in the general fund balance.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Ms. Hassmer, I have a question for you. So in the bonding bills, we typically have a segment of local units of government, and sometimes it's a 50-50 proposition, 50% state share, 50% a local share. What kind of impact does that have on our rating?
Madam Chair, I do not know if the rating agencies look at the non-state financial share that local communities bring to the project. I can review our rating agency reports and see if they've ever mentioned that before.
Okay. And Commissioner, do you know?
Madam Chair, no, that's a great question. I do know that they obviously look over our debt offerings pretty carefully, and I'm not aware either of whether they look particularly at what kind of contribution we're getting from the local level. We'll have to get that for you.
Okay. All right. Members, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck on the rest of your year.
She's doing great, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner for Enterprise Communications and Planning, Janelle Tummel. She's been on the job a little bit longer, but not a whole lot longer, slightly longer.
How long?
About a year.
About a year. All right. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
You can please state your name for the committee and who you represent.
Great. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janelle Tummel, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Enterprise Communications and Planning. The Enterprise Communications and Planning Division provides critical services to the enterprise to ensure that employees, agencies, and agency leaders have the tools and information they need to effectively do their work. Members of the team focus on proactive and inclusive planning strategies to create a culture of collaboration, communication, and information sharing throughout our agency and the enterprise. The division is made up of 5 units, all of which play key roles in helping agencies provide effective services that Minnesotans rely on. The Internal Control and Accountability Unit exists under law to design, implement, and maintain effective internal controls in the executive branch. Internal controls are all of our plans, methods, policies, and procedures that help ensure that what we want to happen actually does happen. The work is critical to the state because it helps operations run efficiently and effectively, safeguard assets, report reliable information about our operations, and comply with laws and regulations. The Unit of Five was created in 2009. It is led by Janine Kuick, who is retiring this month after 39 years of state service. Janine directed the creation of the unit according to state law, and under her leadership, the team has directly improved the state's internal controls. As a result, the team has reduced the opportunity for fraud, waste or abuse, noncompliance, and related fines or loss of funding. Thank you, Janine.
Madam Chair, I might just add that Janine Kuick's retirement on January 27th, I believe, of 39 years really is a milestone. She's just been tremendous. She's an example of someone who's really committed to public service and doing a great job for us. I remember when I first started as Revenue Commissioner in 2011, Commissioner Showalter at MMB at the time recommended that I talk to Janine Kuick about internal controls and audit procedures that I was not familiar with at a state agency. And so she helped me through that time period, and we really owe her a debt of gratitude. So congratulations to her.
Yes, definitely. That is a long time. And that's a difficult position for you as well, to step into a role that someone has held for 39 years. So I wish you the best on that piece.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm trying to learn as much as I can before she leaves.
Yes.
So what have they done over those years? They've really taken some new, created some processes, one of which is meeting with leaders of over 80 agencies, boards, and commission every year. And with through those meetings, the agencies self-assess their internal controls and then certify that the internal control systems that they have are in compliance with laws, policies, and standards. The unit's enabling legislation also requires them to review audit reports from the Office of Legislative Auditor and address any internal control problems. Janine and her team work extensively with agencies to help them review and promptly resolve audit findings. The unit also conducts and coordinates internal control training and educational programs for the enterprise. For example, their Fraud Awareness and Prevention Week of activities in November receives enormous participation by the enterprise because they help educate and train employees about fraud prevention, detection, and reporting techniques. Our business continuity unit provides leadership guidance and coordination to ensure that the executive branch can respond to a disaster and quickly resume priority services, minimize loss, and repair or replace damaged equipment or facilities in a timely and effective manner. The continuity director coordinates statewide continuity and disaster planning with other state agencies, judicial and legislative branches, and federal government, private companies, other states, and community stakeholders. This job exists to make sure Minnesotans can still receive important services they rely on in the event of a weather emergency, such as flooding, a pandemic, a lapse in government funding, or something worse. We plan, practice, and plan again so that when something goes down, we can quickly react or get or keep important government services running for those who depend on them. Our communications unit has three people that are responsible for collaborating with state agencies to proactively communicate key initiatives and information. They manage our website, data requests, media inquiries, social media, publications, internal communications, outreach, and events. The small team does it all, from announcing open enrollment availability to all state employees to marketing the state as an employer of choice. Our Enterprise Resource Planning Unit is a team of two. Our Enterprise IT systems that the Commissioner mentioned earlier are at the heart of what allows the state to do our daily work and provide services that are critical to Minnesotans. From payroll processing, accounting, budgeting, and human resource management, these systems are all connected, and a change in one system affects the rest. This unit is like an air traffic controller, coordinating the development of short and long-term system maintenance and upgrades, the development enhancement plans, including the identification of staffing and financial resources necessary to support those efforts. They do this work with one constant goal, to maintain and continuously improve our systems so they best support the delivery of government services. And a final unit on my team is called Management Analysis and Development, known as MAD. MAD exists under law to support the commissioner's requirement to provide analytical, statistical, and organizational development services to state agencies and other public entities in the state. The team of 16 receives no general fund support. They are a fee-for-service management consulting group, though their rates are more competitive than the private sector. Because MAD is in-house, they know state government and have been helping the state work more effectively since 1985. MAD works with agencies to develop practical solutions when the agency doesn't have the bandwidth or expertise to tackle a problem or a task. The majority of the team's work is research and analysis, often resulting as reports to you all, the legislature. For example, a recent report a report from last year was a legislative report on services for students who are blind or visually impaired that they did for the Department of Education. And that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Members, any questions at all? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, last session in 2016, the governor had recommended $10 million to address statewide security and disaster responsiveness, as I believe. I think you're the right person to ask this question. The legislature granted, I believe, $2 million. So I guess my question is, what have you been able to do with that $2 million to address the needs that apparently were urgent, and what do you anticipate as being the kind of resources necessary next time around?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did receive, I believe it was $2 million for the statewide information financial tool, SWIFT, and we thank you, by the way. And we've been using that to begin the process of upgrading that statewide system. And so that we're utilizing those funds. We'll be asking for some more funds, you know, just to give you a preview coming up in a couple of weeks about needing to do some more work on that statewide system. One of the things about the statewide accounting system, SWIFT, is that it is going to be not supported after January 1, 2018. So one of the difficulties will be after that time, we will not be able to include the normal upgrades and enhancements that software provider puts out, because we don't have a current enough version, which creates problems, because then we have to hire someone to come in and do it on an ad hoc basis or an independent basis. Plus, it reduces your overall security because you're not maintaining the highest level of upgrades. So anyway, to answer your question, that we did utilize that $2 million. We're working on upgrading that system. We'll be reporting back to you in a couple of weeks as we talk about the status of that going forward.
Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner, thank you for your presentation. I was really excited to hear that that part of what you do is and what you're excited about is marketing our state as an employer of choice. I recently saw two studies. One was talking about how our state was losing diversity workforce, that a lot of people of color were leaving our state. There was a flight that was happening. So I want to hear a little bit about the work that you're doing to maintain and your retention program, or anything that your agency is doing to retain that talent. And then a follow-up to that was in the 2014 study done by the American Enterprise Institute found that that the compensation packages of the private sectors and the public sector was a little bit over in most of the states, but Minnesota was one of seven states where we were below what the private sector was offering as a compensation package. How are we trying to be competitive, and how are we trying to retain the best in these fields?
Ms. Dummel?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. I am very passionate about the marketing piece of the work that we do, and really trying to tell the story of what it means to work for the state. And Commissioner Franz will talk a little bit more about the compensation, but that's what we're trying to, you know, talk about the other benefits that you get. You know, people usually enter state government, you know, state service for other reasons besides money. You know, people really want to make a difference. That's why I work here. That's why, you know, a lot of people join our team. So, you know, really getting at the heart of the difference you can make, the involvement that you can have in some of the policies, and working with many of you. So we try to explain what it means to work for the state and provide amazing services to Minnesotans. We also work to better describe the career paths and the things that you can do once you enter state government at whatever level. We're such a unique organization because you can really move throughout state government and grow in your career if that's something that you wish to do. So we have done some really unique or new for the state marketing. For example, this year we had a booth at the Minnesota State Fair, a small booth, but the point of it was to talk about the state as an employer, and rather than having silos and all each agency talking about itself, to talk about the state as one large employer where you can move around if you wish, and the different things and the different jobs that all the different agencies have. We also participated in a state career fair, and then to get at some of the diversity, you know, people of color, we have done more outreach, and you'll hear from Deputy Commissioner Hudson as well a little bit more about that. But we attended a People of Color job fair, which was a huge success, and the interest and the excitement that we heard back from the applicants and the people that we talked to was really exciting.
And Ms. Tumbull, can you talk a little bit too about our health care benefits and how, as part of the compensation package, that's more generous than what's offered traditionally in the private sector, and also when you compare us to other local units of government as well?
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm not an expert in our benefits, and I think you'll hear from, again, our HR team who knows more, but from how our team markets them is we do present them exactly that way as really a great benefits, everything from, you know, time off to FMLA to, you know, sick time and really good health insurance and other amenities like EAP, which is employee assistance program. So just a lot of, you know, softer things that not all organizations or private businesses provide.
Representative Omar.
Okay.
Go ahead. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the things that Deputy Commissioner Hudson will come up and talk a little bit more about, the retention, the recruiting aspect, and Director Julie Saunier of the State Employee Health Plan will come up and talk about some of those benefits. I would just close on this particular topic before your question about the state fair. I was at the booth several times during the state fair, and I had a number of parents come up to me saying, do you have a job for my son or daughter? Because it's time for them to move out of the house, kind of a thing. But it was so I was happy to help them out. But it was a new thing for us to be at the state fair, letting people to come to the state fair know that you were looking for people. There are some good job opportunities, and get that son or daughter off the couch and to work. So that was kind of a fun opportunity for us.
So you're a job broker for parents now.
Exactly. Nice.
Excellent. Representative Omar, any other questions?
No.
Okay. Members, any other questions?
I have one question.
Representative Kunesh Pudin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. So how are we doing at retaining some of the talent that you're bringing in? Are we able to keep them for a good amount of time and invest in the future? Are they willing to stick around for that?
Ms. Tumbull?
Madam Chair,
or Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, actually Deputy Commissioner Hudson will give you more figures about retention levels, what we're trying to do, and how expensive lack of retention can be and why it's so critical that once we get people here, we train them and keep them here. But he'll have some more figures on that for you.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm. 39 years.
Yes, right. Look at that. That's a great return on investment.
I just have one question. When I look through and listen to your testimony, too, what kind of cooperation or collaboration do you do with the Department of Administration? Because much of what you've covered here is a lot what they do with the Department of Administration. So have you guys looked at what areas of where you have overlap and maybe trying to kind of figure that piece out?
Madam Chair, representatives, we do, you know, collaborate with Department of Administration as well as all agencies. For example, under the continuity unit, they have a person at admin who we work closely with to particularly focus on facilities. So if, you know, if a building or something, you know, happens, an emergency or disaster, we have already worked with them and collaborated with the Department of Admin to develop an alternate space that's ready to go for an agency, for example.
Okay. I think it might be helpful, Commissioner, at some point to have you and Commissioner Mossman talk about the differences between the two programs that you offer and then the similarities as well, because I'm just curious if an agency shops around for the best answer between the two of you on how that works, and maybe we can get a better model in place. So,
thank you, Matt. You know, that's a good idea. And I think one of the things that happened, what night was that? Was that Thursday night? We had the lights out at the Ways and Means.
Yeah, that was crazy.
And so on that night, I mean, it's a good example, though, the Department of Administration that they were working on, because it was a facilities issue on campus. They were coordinating because I think there were some lights out at the Capitol, maybe in transportation, so there's a campus problem that they were working with, but they were in communication with our office as well, trying to figure out, well, is this just a couple hours, and a half an hour, or overnight thing, or what if it doesn't last through the night? Do we need alternative places to meet? So that was a conversation we had that night.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Thummel.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer, did you have a question?
I apologize. Hang on one second.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and this is for Commissioner Franz. How involved are you with different agencies when the legislative auditor does an audit and there's issues that are coming up? I know there's an audit being done on the Department of Veterans Affairs. What role do you play in working with those agencies?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. We work closely with them, and one of the things that we try to do when an audit is ongoing with another agency is to work with the agency to make sure that we can help them get all the necessary information, because sometimes the issue at a particular agency may involve funding or program requirements, and so we work with them to make sure they understand the program requirements or the interpretation by the Office of Legislative Auditor. And so we work very closely with the Office of Legislative Auditor in adding, we think, value to that process so that but it's, you know, ultimately the duty of the agency to answer those questions, but we try to work closely with them.
All right, thank you. I have two more.
Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up Deputy Commissioner, Enterprise, Human Capital, Edward Hudson. This was Assistant Commissioner Stumble's first testimony. How did she do?
Congratulations. You passed.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Edwin Hudson, and I serve Minnesotans as the Deputy Commissioner of Enterprise Human Capital. Reporting to Commissioner Myron Franz, my duties include supporting leadership and guiding the human resource leadership agencies, boards, commissions throughout the state of Minnesota. Our EHC team consists of nearly 50 state employees and additional 43 CGIP employees. Together, we support a workforce of about 55,000 state employees, including Minnesota State Colleges, universities, and the judicial branch. Our division is comprised of the following units and sections: labor relations, enterprise learning and development, recruiting and retention, compensation and classification, state employees insurance group, known as CGIP, research, policies, and projects. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of those units and divisions that we have. We'll start with labor relations. The state of Minnesota is the state's largest employer. 79% of our employees are represented by 9 different bargaining units. The last bargaining cycle, we successfully ratified 8 of the 9 negotiated agreements, with 1 going to arbitration. The legislature approved all 8 in 2016. LR directed and resolved 365 employee grievances between July 1st, 2014 and June 30th, 2016. To equip them to manage in an inclusive environment, our LR team spends countless hours working with managers, supervisors, HR professionals, coaching them, training them, and interpreting policies and bargaining agreements. This is a substantial workload for a relatively small unit, and we continue to expect plan for increased work associated with legislation relative to veterans preference hearings and the Public Employment Relations Board, PERB. Veterans make up approximately 7.2% of our employee workforce, and we're pleased and we're working to even improve that number even beyond where we are, our current success. Let me tell you a little bit about our Enterprise Learning and Development Department, known as ELD for short. The state ELD is the state's employee training organization supporting professional development needs of our talented workforce. The state statute MS-43A.21 states that no supervisor or manager will be certified off of probation without first going through training. ELD provides the required 40 hours training for our supervisors, and we also provide 36 of the 80 hours training, required training for managers. ELD also contracts with agencies to provide customized training and seminars for employees. Example of customized training would include professional development, 360-degree feedback, Gallup strength finders, customer service, open enrollment, pre-retirement, and retirement seminars. ELD services were utilized by 10%, 5,530 of state employees in FY15-16. Fees collected for training per MS Statute 4321, Subsection 2, allows us to collect fees, and those fees were used to pay for all 10 of our training facilitators. Our current fee structure is a training model that mostly allows our large funded agencies to address their training needs for some of their employees. So we have some other smaller, mid to smaller size agencies that aren't getting the training proportionately for their employees. Some employees are going without training. MMB is evaluating a different fair share model that will enable ELD to better meet the professional development needs of all state employees. I've been charged to review the training programs, and we're currently exploring options for providing training and development in a more consistent and effective manner by looking at approaches used at large organizations in the private sector. ELD recently met with cabinet-level agencies to assess our organizational training and developmental needs. Additionally, we have formed 5 advisory groups consisting of agency leadership and frontline employees, and that the output of that information is going to help us inform our work in this area. Now let me tell you a little bit about recruiting, retention, affirmative action, equal opportunity section. Statute states that the commissioner, in cooperation with appointing authorities of all state agencies, shall maintain an active recruiting program publicly conducted and designed to attract sufficient number of well-qualified people to meet the needs of the civil service and to enhance the image and public esteem of state service employment. Special emphasis shall be given to recruitment of veterans and protected group members to assist state agencies in meeting affirmative action goals to achieve a balanced workforce. This division is responsible for full cycle recruiting and retention strategies that would prevent skill shortages, retain a diverse workforce to serve the richness of our demographics in the state, and to promote the state of Minnesota as an employer of choice. Now, realizing the value of a diverse and inclusive workforce, we're tracking the progress with our disparate hires. Persons with disabilities make up 6.3% of the state's workforce, 7.2% of our veterans, as mentioned previously, 14.9% people who identify as racial or ethnic minorities, and then, of course, we have 49.8% females. In 2012, the legislature appointed $4 million to upgrade our state's application tool. By the way, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for doing that. We still have a little work to go, but we appreciate you doing that. Since its full inception and launch in December 2015, we've processed an average of 15,458 applications for state jobs each month. That's 15,458 applications of state jobs each month. The state of Minnesota hires on an average of 600 external applicants per year. Okay? Our applicant helpline staff assists on an average of 1,050 applications per month. So we have various ways for Minnesotans who are having some difficulties perhaps putting in an application. They can either send us a contact by email. There's a hotline they can call. But if you count all total, just over 1,000 inquiries per month from Minnesotans. We continue to make improvements with the number of inquiries from Minnesotans for assistance, and we significantly decrease that number over time because we're finding more efficiencies online and we're trying to address some of their concerns online. And certainly, we're making it even simpler to navigate through the system. We still have some challenges, but we're working through some of those things. Even so, we are often reminded by disability organizations of the urgent need to make recruiting solutions more accessible for persons with disabilities. Our state workforce is shrinking. A third, that's 15,000, of our active employees are eligible to retire today. The federal unemployment rate is 4.6%. The state's unemployment rate is 3.8%. Anything less than 5% in the labor market is considered full unemployment. That said, we do recognize that the unemployment rate in some communities may exceed this rate. Last year, we lost 16,000 combined years of employee experience through retirements alone. That represents a wealth of intellectual capital. Turnover rates among tenured state employees is also, less tenured state employees is also rising. So the market right now is being infiltrated with the millennials, and right now we're seeing an uptick in retention even in the millennials right now. Turnover is disruptive and it's expensive. It can cost 100 to 300% of an employee's annual base salary to source, recruit, hire, and to onboard new talent. Our overall turnover rate for the state is right at about 10%. But if you look at inside of that 10%, if you look at just, say, the ethnic minority cohort, then it exceeds. We're almost approaching 13%. So within the 11%, if you just extrapolate the ethnic minority cohort, that number is growing to get to the point that we heard a little earlier a few moments ago. Our overall turnover rate is high. Resources to establish talent pipeline in this late tight labor market is very sparse. Very sparse. These numbers further illustrate challenges we face in our state's recruiting and retention efforts. Our compensation strategies are not as competitive with other local governments governmental agencies or the private sector. This disparity vastly impedes our ability to compete to attract and retain talent in a tight labor market. The state is already seeing this strained demand with unique positions such as forensic psychologists, tax examiners, certified nurse assistants, and other skilled and unskilled trades. Madam Chair and members of the committee, your positive narrative in legislative hearings and committee members meetings set a tone for statewide recruiting efforts, and it certainly helps our employees feel that they're valued. The governor and this legislator is the biggest asset that we can use in our recruiting and retention efforts. Thank you. And thank you for being mindful of that, and know that state employees are eagerly here to serve the governor and this legislature and all Minnesotans. Now let me talk a little bit about compensation and classification.
Deputy Commissioner, if you would, I'm just looking at the time, and there is a couple other things that we need to do, and you have one more person. After Deputy Commissioner speaks, I'm going to interrupt, and then go through the spreadsheets that I have from Ms. Roberts, and then we can have your final person from there. It looks to me that you have some documents that you're using, too. If you wish to share those with us as a committee, that would be helpful. I do have Representative Olson on the list, and I do have a question for you as well. But if you would, please proceed.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I'll start and tell you a little bit about our Class and Compensation Department. This division provides strategic oversight and direction of the job classification and employee compensation structure for executive branch employees, and ensures that our pay practices are compliant with federal and state requirements. We recommend and implement program changes to the compensation and classification structure to ensure that the state, as an employer, is meeting the statutory and contractual obligations in a way that effectuates good stewardship of taxpayers' dollars. We also ensure equitable pay for the employees of the state of Minnesota, along with oversight of gender equity and compensation in all local governmental agencies as required by state statute. This is important, but sometimes this area is overlooked for managing risk in a large organization. It's my belief that to stay ahead of the curve, we must redouble our efforts as it relates to providing enterprise training on class and compensation rules, as well as providing additional support and oversight of our pay practices. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Hudson. I really appreciate the clarity around the efforts and the needs you have to really reflect the community that we are with your hiring and who you retain. So that was really clear. Could you just speak briefly to the management level or higher around the diversity? I know when you take the full, you gave some really good numbers on diversity around different categories, but do you happen to know or could speak to management level or higher in that regard?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rep. We track that information. I don't have it with me. We look at it at 18 M's and above. We track that, and then, of course, we track all of our hires that are taken. We break that out by various classifications. Yes, but I can tell you a little bit about our statewide recruiter. We have hired them to focus specifically on 18 M's and above, which would be our senior level position, and we are very intentional in our efforts. We are working in the community to establish good working relationships so they can refer individuals with us. We have fabulous relationship with foundations, and we have a good base of about maybe 400 different partners who see the openings that we have. We advertise them with them, and then they help us with making referrals. So we're very intentional in our efforts in this area, and I can provide you those specific numbers at another time.
Representative Olson. Okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner. Actually, this question comes from one of my constituents, and he's involved with labor relations and things like that, too. The question was, you know, your agency negotiates contracts with the 13 state employee bargaining units and everything else. how do you stay at arm's length with the negotiations when, of course, we have state employees negotiating state employment contracts with other state employees? How do you stay at arm's length with regard to the negotiations? Do you use outside arbitrators, and do you occasionally use outside management consultants during your negotiations?
Well,
Deputy Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair. Rep, we use outside arbitration resources in employee relations type matters. We use the Bureau of Mediation to support us when we need to go in arbitration within negotiation. But our negotiated process, it's a collaborative process. We work together. We're very professional in how we negotiate. We try to maintain good relationships. We recognize that it's not necessary to be adversarial. We believe that we can get a lot more accomplished taking a collegial approach. But we're very mindful. We're very mindful that we have different interests. And that arm's length is something that really comes natural, that distance.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I appreciate the question. Bargaining is, I think, one of the challenges that I had in taking over this role at MMB. It does require that you approach that situation with an arm's length, you know, basis, and that you represent the interests of the state. But one of the ways that you do that is realizing that you, as representing the state, you only have so much money, right? And that ultimately that contract has to come back before this body. I mean, there are some... I'm just saying that there's a mechanism. We clearly understand the people who we work with. We get along with them. We work day-to-day with them, and then they're in the bargaining units, and then we have to go and, you know, get on different sides of the room and have that bargaining. It's always a delicate thing. I think it's one is that you have to approach with a lot of respect for both sides and realize there's only so much that we can do as a state, and we try to be fair. And I think as long as you're fair and open and transparent, the system works. But it's a delicate balance.
Representative Hugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, well, yeah, I think we all understand that, and the labor negotiations are extremely difficult, whether you're talking public sector or private sector. But again, you know, one of the most important things is taking care of the taxpayers' money and their dollars. And this question came to me from a constituent, and I thought it was a great question. How do you keep arm's length when you're doing that? And, of course, his suggestion was that an outside third party should be doing it. So, you know, that would be a paradigm shift, obviously. But nonetheless, you know, to achieve savings and, of course, keep everybody happy, because we know we have a competitive labor market with such low unemployment, those are things we have to take care of and be cognizant of. But on the other hand, there's a little bit of angst about some of that.
And Deputy Commissioner, kind of to that whole situation too, how important is it to not have changes outside of the collective bargaining agreement process?
Well, Madam Chair and Rep, to answer the question, both questions that's on the floor, there are different bargaining types. There's what we call interest-based bargaining, which is more, it takes away positions. We don't engage in that type of bargaining. The type of bargaining we engage in is very positional, and that's the more traditional bargaining, where we start with a budget and we put our interests based on our budget on the table, and we just kind of go at it. So the process in itself lends itself to the space and the distance, so that we it's not like interest-based bargaining where you look for mutual interests. In this instance, our technique, it's we start with our own positions, and your position is your position, and my position is my position. So that's a process that lends itself to the distance I believe you're asking about. With regards to outside influence, Would you repeat that question again, please?
So how important is it to not have negotiations outside of the collective bargaining agreement or changes? If a legislator were to come up with a change to the agreement that you've negotiated, you know, what is the level of importance? Is that important or is it not important?
When we have, Madam Chair, when we bargain, we have MOUs in place, we have bargaining agreements in place, and it is basically the starting line from which we need to begin, and we have to bargain within the terms of those agreements. Sometimes when there are some things mentioned outside of the bargaining process, we may not be at liberty to use that, whatever it is. We're speaking in hypotheticals here, so it's a little difficult to answer you more direct than that. It is difficult for an outside influence to take place during bargaining when we have some parameters set.
Well, let me ask you this. If you were in the middle of contract negotiations and I were to ask you, I'm going to make this change from a legislative perspective, would that have a positive or negative effect on your collective bargaining?
Madam Chair, I suppose it would depend on when it would go into effect. If you were to implement a change, that change would likely go into effect the next bargaining cycle. I'm not sure. Again, it's a little tough to answer the question, and I'm not.
So if the legislature were to come up with some benefits and we said this is what the benefits are going to be, and it was different than what you were proposing or what you had agreed to, how would you guys view that?
Let me try. Madam Chair, well, I mean, it would be different. I mean, obviously, it's the way the process has worked, you know, over the years is to bargain the contracts and then before the legislature and have them voted up or down. And so to the extent the legislature proposed some terms, I think that would be something that both sides would have to look at a little bit differently. Obviously, we would have the force and effect of law from our point of view in terms of bargaining. I don't know. I think you have to ask the bargaining units kind of how they would view that. I'm not sure.
Great. Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner. Our Deputy Commissioner, I have a couple of quick questions, I think. One of my local governments does this reporting that you mentioned, the gender equity reporting, and they complain seriously about this because of the time and the cost involved. And what would you say about perhaps a community that was consistently over a period of years reporting meeting or exceeding the guidelines, and that they might be excused maybe we do a report from them once every 3 years or every 5 years instead of every year. Would that be a possibility? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's pretty within the realm of possibility. Obviously, we're trying to implement the legislation and the mm-hmm. statute as written, but we're open to ways to do that. The goal, obviously, is to make sure that these local governments abide by those rules, and I think there could be some flexibility in how we go about doing that. So we'd be happy to talk about that.
Thank you. I have another question.
Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the minority turnover is higher than the general population. Can you tell us why and what you're doing about that to improve that?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Thank you. We're trying to peel the onion back, so to speak, to identify what the causes are, and we're in the process of making some repurposing of positions to allow us to look into this a little bit more. We have some anecdotal reasons. We're not sure. Pay certainly is a reason, not just with this cohort, but it's with all of our employees. That is a constant reason why they're leaving. We just simply cannot compete even with governmental agencies. In fact, we just lost a very talented resource last week in our office that left and went to a governmental agency. We just can't compete on the actual compensation piece.
One more question.
Representative Ward.
So I'm assuming you're saying going to local government as opposed to the state government when they're moving away. My other question is about the shortage of the workforce. We hear a lot about shortages in technical fields and some other areas and concern about our educational system providing high school and college graduates, I'm wondering if that are meeting the workforce needs. I'm wondering if you're seeing that, or are you working primarily with mature prospects? You obviously have, if you're having 13,000 or 15,000 a month and you're only hiring 600 a year, it seems like the pool is large. But what are you missing?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you. I think the answer to both questions is yes, and I can give you an example. MDVA was cited a little earlier. They asked us to come in and work with them. We sent the team out. We dispatched the team, and we found out that one of the skill shortages was the HST, the health service technicians. Mm-hmm. And so we're working with them to create a pipeline with our schools, our high schools, mm-hmm. so that college graduates can start in their junior year and they can tailor their education so they can have this position, and those who are interested in health care, this would be an option for them. And the hope is that we would secure them early and then convert them upon graduation. So that's how we're trying to address the pipeline piece of that. Mm-hmm. The other part of your question was relative to other positions, more skilled positions. Mm-hmm. We're very challenged in that area, and turnover, the more skilled that's required, the more the turnover is, and to be honest with you, there's also a correlation, even compensation. That's an area where we can't compete the more technical the position is. By the way, there was a little question earlier. If you look at comparing ourselves to the private sector, it is true that we cannot compete. That's largely true. However, there are some positions where we compete pretty nicely. And the lower the position is in classification, we tend to compete fairly well. But the more technical the position becomes, then we can't compete, such as maybe an attorney or such as maybe a psychologist. Or even there's some areas that we can't compete with the private sector because the position doesn't exist. Take, for an example, our highway state patrol officers. Mm-hmm. There's no one to compete with in the private sector for this position. We can only compete with other state governments. So, yes, for the most part, we are finding that we can't compete. Largely, that is true. There are some positions on the lower classification scale where we can absolutely compete.
It's very helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So here's what we're going to do. We have Representative Detmer and Representative Quam have questions for you. I'm going to have them state the question and then offline if you can provide them and the entire committee with the response to that. Then we're going to have Ms. Sonier, if you can come forward and get ready to rock and roll here. And then we need to wrap up in 3 minutes. So quickly, if you can state your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner, you mentioned that 7.3 of your employees were veterans. Could you get the information to the committee, you know, where these veterans, what agencies they're employed in? And then the 7.3%, are we increasing, or is it been kind of level? Has it been level like this? Or, and then maybe share with the committee how the veterans' preference works within the agency. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm after is the intellectual capital we're losing because people are retiring, they've been working for decades. What policies and procedures have been implemented to try and capture that and document that so it's available for training and reference in the future?
Great. Good, and with that, you have Ms. Sonier. Yeah. Am I saying this right, I hope?
Sonier.
Sonier. Boy.
Above, Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I can assure you that when I leave, there will be no intensive capital intellectual property lost, I guarantee you.
Well, you lucked out. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Sonier, and I'm the Director of the State Employee Group Insurance Program, or CGIP, at Minnesota Management and Budget. We currently have a staff of 43 employees.
43?
43. We offer comprehensive insurance benefits to ensure that state employees and their families have access to quality insurance at an affordable cost. The benefits include health, dental, life, long and short-term disability, and long-term care insurance. In addition, we administer pre-tax accounts for medical and dental care, dependent care, and transit expenses. Insurance benefits are a valuable component of the compensation, and they help the state attract and retain a talented workforce. CGIP insurance benefits are provided to employees in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of state government, as well as the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. Over 54,000 employees participate in CGIP coverage. When we count dependents and retirees, we cover a total of over 127,000 people with our health insurance. In fiscal year 2016, total CGIP spending was $860 million, with health insurance accounting for nearly 90% of that amount. I also want to mention that in conjunction with CGIP, we also operate the Public Employees Insurance Program, or PEIP, which currently provides coverage to about 23,000 people who are enrolled through 149 local units of government in Minnesota. And in fiscal year 2016, that program spent about $106 million. As Minnesota's largest employer purchaser of health care, CGIP has significant influence in the marketplace, and we use purchasing strategies that are designed to contain cost and provide access to high-quality care. We also have a comprehensive set of initiatives that promote employee health and well-being, which result in a more productive state workforce and also help to contain health care costs. So in the time that remains, I just wanted to provide you a few specific examples of some of the strategies that we use to contain health care costs and cost growth in CGIP. One of those is that we are attempting increasingly to pay providers on value of care provided, not just the volume of services. So traditionally, healthcare providers get paid more the more things that they do, but there's increasingly focus on changing that so that the incentives are such that providers have incentives to contain cost and improve quality. In 2015, about half of the $721 million in healthcare claims that we paid were paid through these types of arrangements that incentivize higher quality and lower cost. And we're encouraging our health plan administrators to do even more in this regard. A second way that we contain costs is through our tiered provider network. So we have an innovative health plan design that encourages our members to choose clinics that provide care at the lower cost. So if you choose a lower cost clinic, your deductible is lower, your copayments are lower. Nearly 90% of CGIP members currently choose clinics in the lowest two cost tiers. So our members are clearly drawn to those lowest cost tiers, and that also is very apparent to healthcare providers in Minnesota who want to be placed in those lower tiers, and quite frequently that allows us to get better prices from those providers as well. A third way that we contain costs is by holding our vendors accountable. So we structure our contracts with health plans and our pharmacy benefit manager to help ensure cost containment. So, for example, we include financial incentives that are tied to specific cost containment goals at the health plan level. We also ensure that we get the lowest pharmacy prices and that all rebates from prescription drug manufacturers are passed on to the state. And then finally, we have some significant activities around chronic disease prevention that I wanted to mention. So when we prevent an employee, for example, from developing diabetes or heart disease, we save the state taxpayers money as well as employees, and our employees are in better health. In April 2015, we launched a diabetes prevention program that enrolled over 5,300 members in its first 17 months. To date, state employees have lost over 43,000 pounds through this program, and over 1,600 state employees have reduced their risk of developing diabetes by more than 50%. That's really significant because a person with diabetes has average healthcare costs that are 2.3 times higher than someone who doesn't. So this is a great example of how investing in these types of things saves taxpayers and employees money in the long run. Wanted to quickly mention that this program also won a state government innovation award in 2016 from the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you quickly today, and I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any follow-up questions.
And members, we will have Ms. Sonier come back another day. I know that there are members that are interested in kind of boiling down your entire budget, and that was not part of today's presentation, so we will go through all of that when we have an opportunity. Members, also, too, I want to remind you to look through the information, the spreadsheets here that you have in your folder. We will be having the commissioner come back at a later time to go through those items as well, hopefully beyond the governor's budget proposal, so we'll get a chance to kind of go through those. I have several questions on those spreadsheets alone, so that'll take some time. So we will have you back. And with that, members, if you have questions, they're all here. Feel free to grab them before they leave, and I know that they'll share their responses with the entire committee so we can all benefit from the questions that you ask. And with that, we are adjourned.